From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week we'll sing with Ella, learn how two art projects are connecting neighbors in two communities, and study the score for a classic silent film. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, it's disheartening to drive by abandoned, rundown houses, but leave it to artists to come to the rescue. Later this hour, we learn about the House Life Project. But first, when you go see a movie, there's always a beautifully paced soundtrack that underscores the emotional content of the film. But when movies were silent, that soundtrack was provided live. That's an experience recreated by the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra each season, and Indianapolis Business Journal Arts and Entertainment editor Lou Harry invited the ICO's music director Matthew Kramer and principal bassoon Kara Stoll to talk about the challenges and pleasures of playing a live soundtrack to a classic film.
Ask the veteran first. Kara, tell us, how many of these have you done with the ICO?
I've actually done these from the beginning, since we started these about 10 years ago. So I've actually been fortunate enough to have played all of them.
Is there a difference in sound? How do you musically classify sort of the difference between the sound of these silent movie scores versus any other music that the chamber orchestra might be doing?
You know, I think because there's such a visual with it, you get a sense of a different of character. Mm-hmm. That comes through, which you can hear when you're just watching the orchestra play. There's certainly a lot more variety in short spurts of time, which is interesting. You can go from elegant and lyrical to sassy and comical a lot quicker than you can, you know, in the period of a piece in the orchestra on stage. So it's a lot of variety in a short period of time.
Matthew, tell us a little bit about the choices available for these kind. Obviously, the chamber orchestra has been doing these one a year, and you've been with them for about 2 years now. What's available out there? Is there a vast supply of these scores?
It's quite surprising, actually. There's a vast wealth of this material, and it only every year increases as more and more composers are adding scores to movies which no longer have scores. For example, last season was Harold Lloyd's Speedy, which had a relatively newly composed score by Carl Davis, who's done numerous. But it's very important, I think, as an artistic effort, not only an entertainment effort, to put a movie on like Charlie Chaplin's City Lights that has Chaplin's original score that was composed to it. Mm-hmm. So it is a very historical document, and as Kara was alluding to, I mean, this is a sound, you know, kind of a window to what these sounds of the dance halls were in the 1920s.
People also, I think, may not realize as we get further away from it, there's the assumption that these were, you know, silent movies from the teens and 20s that a piano player played. But Chaplin, at this point, had the option of doing sound. This was, you know, sound movies were out there, and this was by choice in his career. Do you hear a difference between a score like that, which is by the composer was written in the time, versus something that was created today to go with a silent film?
Actually, as I mentioned, Carl Davis, who mm-hmm. did a number of the scores that the ICO has played in the last 10 years, you know, he's a chameleon because he has studied the original scores from the late 20s and very early 30s. You know, and also many similarities in the sounds of Gershwin, for example. You'll hear at the very beginning of City Lights a glissando, which obviously comes from Rhapsody in Blue, you know, which had its premiere in the 20s. So whether the score is original or not, I think you'll hear modern composers who are writing, you know, really kind of adapt this language of the dance halls, of early jazz, when they're writing the score. So they try to be as original as possible. Other composers have not. Stuart Copeland, for example, wrote a film score for the early version of Ben-Hur, and it's got a lot of percussion in it. So, you know, it depends on where the composer is coming from, whether they're trying to be, you know, true to the original nature of the film or whether they're looking at this as a living, breathing document that can be adapted for the ages, much like we do with theater.
Chaplin said that it took him 3 weeks to get the timing right. The score was composed and performed, from what I understood, after the film was complete. He was in there with musicians in the studio, getting the timing right, taking about 3 weeks to do that. Tell me about the rehearsal schedule for the ICO for an average concert. I mean, these are professional musicians who all also have other gigs elsewhere.
The good thing about the chamber orchestra is that we play fairly frequently together in many settings. So when we come together, it's fairly easy for us to put something together because we're very familiar with each other as a whole. And these we actually put together in a fairly short period of time. We have, I believe, two rehearsals to throw this together.
Are there particular moments? I know in past films sometimes there would be gunshots or the backfire of a car or things that require that kind of split-second timing, which can be tricky, I would imagine, when you're in the pit and a film's happening, you know, behind your back sometimes.
In many ways, though, that kind of adds to the excitement of it being live, because if, you know, if the train crashes into something in the middle of the track, you know, but the sound happens just before or just after, you know, the audience kind of gets a kick out of something like that. I mean, ideally, you want things to line up perfectly, but it's kind of all a part of the live experience.
How does this performance, this part of your offerings, fit into your overall vision for the chamber orchestra?
It's one very important component of what a chamber orchestra's history is. I'm often asked, what's the difference between a symphony and a chamber orchestra? A chamber orchestra is the size orchestra that Mozart or Haydn would have written for. I mean, really, would have performed in the palaces of kings and queens and in early music halls, too. The way I look at it, this is, again, as I've said, one component of what our history is as a small-sized orchestra or early movie theaters and supplying scores and accompaniment for early silent films. So these are treasures which I think many people, you know, when they have the opportunity to see it, especially with live orchestral accompaniment, can appreciate the genius that went behind Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, these early entrepreneurs in film. So to be able to, you know, as I said, to treat it as a living, breathing document of early film history, I think it's important, just as important in many respects as our Handel or our Mozart.
And when you say small orchestra, we're not talking tiny. For those who have not seen the chamber orchestra, you're talking how many players?
34 musicians.
Right.
So we can go even smaller, and we often do in concerts. We did a program in November that required 12 musicians. So it's fun. You know, and when I'm programming, I think about that. Isn't it neat if we open the door and all of a sudden, you know, 16 more people will come in for a five-minute piece, and then they leave, and everyone's wondering what's going on. So we're malleable. You know, it's really what is so interesting about this treasure trove of music that we have available to us, and film scores as well. We'll have a banjo. We'll have three saxophones there, instruments that you usually don't welcome into the orchestra are, of course, the backbone in many respects of this sound from the 1920s.
And for those who have been to previous ones, change of venue this year, correct? You're at the Schrott this year?
Yes, I'm very excited about this, actually. We had a wonderful partnership with the IMA, and we hope many of their patrons who have enjoyed the silent film series will come over to the Schrott. What I'm excited about is that the Schrott is, as we have said since the moment we moved in there, a state-of-the-art, world-class concert facility. The acoustics are exquisite. So for us to be on stage in the best acoustical environment for the orchestra to perform this 90-minute film score really allows us to perform and to sound our very best. The screen is projected over the orchestra, so really the audience has a very comfortable venue to be kind of involved and really hands-on into this experience. The screen is right there. The orchestra is right there. It's one of the many things that makes this new genre of concert experience so popular with orchestras, whether it's E.T. or Raiders of the Lost Ark or City Lights. You get to see the whole thing happening. And as you mentioned, the police whistles and the fire sirens, all of that stuff, you get to see it firsthand.
Will popcorn be available?
Are we doing popcorn?
I don't think we are for this. I'm not
sure. They let us take drinks into the Schrott now, but I think popcorn is probably another checklist we have to go through.
Contributor Lou Harry with Matthew Kramer and Kara Stoll. The Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's City Lights concert and movie screening is March 18th at the Schrott Center on Butler's campus. Tickets are available at iclmusic.org. The John and James L. Knight Foundation, you might recognize that name from their support of public broadcasting, got lots of mail a few months ago. They put out the call for their third annual Knight Cities Challenge, an effort that connects the arts, technology, and public spaces to make life better. Last year, Gary, Indiana won funding from this effort for its Art House Social Kitchen. This year, Fort Wayne has a project that's one of 144 finalists, and I invited Raina Bradley to tell me about the Porch Project.
Tell us what Community Design Studio is in the first place, and then how you decided places like Front Porches might be the place to go to connect people.
Sure. So the Porch Studio pop-up idea initially actually came out of our community. So we typically ask our community members what they want and try to form all our projects in response. So with the Porch Project, our community members told us that they wanted actually improved crime. They wanted to feel safer in the neighborhood, and they wanted to know each other a bit more. And crime here in Mount Vernon Park has fallen precipitously in the past couple of years. So, for example, we had 33 burglaries in a neighborhood of 550 houses in 2013, all the way down to 5 now.
Wow.
Which made my thought that, you know, the issue of crime is about perception of crime and about the history. So why don't we provide space for people to see each other, to know each other, to get out of their houses, to have those informal interactions? And that's where the Porch Project idea came from. We have like a ton of 1950s salt box houses in our neighborhood, very little ornamentation, maybe a couple awnings. But we thought, why not generate porches? And porch as exterior rooms, so like a 6-foot deep something maybe. And why don't we then use those porches as a vehicle or a canvas to pull some of the culture that's on the interior of our homes onto the exterior? So to, you know, create space where the Hispanic community, the Burmese community, the Afro-American community, the community of European descent can have some sort of identity on the exterior of their homes. So that's the idea in a nutshell. And then the grant itself, we kind of see as phase one of that. So that it would be a space where we can kind of test that idea, let people see what it would look like, what it would feel like by seeing those porches out of like particle board or something of that nature. So getting them up, installing them temporarily, and then hopefully moving on to a phase two where we do more permanent installations.
That's so intriguing because, you know, as you described the, you know, 1950s kind of subdivision, all the houses look alike, kind of mm-hmm. like a Monopoly game, and you drive by or you walk by or bicycle by, and you have no idea who's inside, what they, how they cook, who, you know,
yes.
who their friends are, what they do for fun. So the idea of drawing people outside just visually to start with and then in three dimensions is so intriguing.
Well, thank you.
The side benefit, too, is getting people away from backlit screens a little bit, right?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, even if they take the backlit screens outside, at least, you know, at least they're outside. At least, and it, but you're exactly right. To get them out, to give them the opportunities to wave, to say hi, to say hello. Because one of the other concerns that we have as a community is that people are concerned about our kids walking to school. In Fort Wayne, if you're within a mile as a bird flies from your elementary school, your kids need to walk. They won't be bused. And so in the winter, our kids walk to school very early when it's quite dark. And so a lot of people were like, well, what about our kids walking to school? I was like, well, if there was space for people to stand outside and watch, that would feel like a much safer walk than, you know, than it does without having that space. So absolutely, just the safety, the interaction, it's all in there.
It's a way of building a community. It's kind of like an extended family.
Yes, exactly right.
Did you yourself grow up with in a place where there were front porches and where neighbors knew one another? I'm curious.
No, I didn't. I grew up in a very suburban neighborhood where we knew, I think, maybe our four neighbors, you know, across the street and next door on either side. But then I went to college. I went to school in D.C., and I lived in a row house.
Oh.
And I think that was the first time I actually knew all my neighbors. And it was because everyone hung out, rain or shine, you know, maybe not in snow, on our porches. So even though that was a community where perhaps my parents were a little more concerned than they even would be naturally, I felt safest there because I knew everyone on my walk to and from school.
Raina Bradley spoke to the Art of the Matter about Fort Wayne's Bridge of Grace Compassionate Ministries Center's Porch Project. The goal is to bring community members together through a community design studio that activates informal gathering spaces, including front porches. The Porch Project is a finalist in the third Night Cities Challenge. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, Beauty and the Beast dance to a new score. But first, an Internet Cat Video Festival, a cat circus. Indy, for sure, loves its feline friends. The newest endeavor centered on four-legged furries is Fountain Square's Nine Lives Cat Cafe. And this week, Eat Drink Indy's Jolene Ketzenberger visits with co-owner Selena Hubbard and her dad, Eric.
So the cat cafe, Nine Lives Cat Cafe. So tell me how the idea for a cat cafe, a coffee house where there are cats, how did the idea come about?
I first read years ago about cat cafes in Asia. I believe the first one was in Taiwan. And I read about ones in Japan and South Korea. And I was like, oh, this is the most amazing idea ever. I love coffee. I love cats. Whoever thought of this is just like a genius. And then they weren't in the U.S. at the time. And just the health department regulations would not allow, like in Japan, you know, the cats are crawling on the counters and things like that. And that would not go over very well here. But whenever they started opening in the U.S., they had made a division with the cats on one side and then coffee on the other side with a wall. So they were in separate rooms. And so then they started popping up all over the U.S. with that same, like, concept of like dividing the place in half. And so we're like, okay, cat cafes can happen in the U.S. We need this to happen in Indy. So
now, did you get much pushback? Did people think that was kind of the idea was a little out there?
Yeah, well, it kind of just depends. Like, people are like really black and white on it. It's either, oh my gosh, that's the best idea, I love cats, I love coffee, you guys are great, or it's just like, ew, that sounds terrible, I'm not a cat lover, I don't want cat fur in my coffee, it's going to stink. Like, you hear all these different things. So people are either like really negative about it, or they're really, really excited. And there's not really a gray area, which is kind of funny.
Now, you're in, opened this with your dad, Eric. So what did you think about the idea when the idea of a cat cafe came up?
Well, I was always receptive to the idea of partnering with her for business. But when she brought up the cats, you know, I'm the boring business part of this partnership. And it was a tough sell for her. I knew that they existed. I wasn't really sure what Indianapolis would think of a cat cafe. And when it became apparent that we were going to be self-funding, then it became even more critical that we have a solid business plan and really have a good idea that we were going to be able to make this. So it was a tough sell for her.
So because, you know, I can understand, you know, the idea is a little unusual, but it seems to have really taken off. So I think that there must have been some interest out there, some pent-up demand that we didn't know that we had for a cat cafe.
And really, part of what made all this work was the alliances and partnerships that we made with people who are like-minded. So even though we were on this endeavor on our own, we really weren't. Our coffee roaster, for instance, he also helped us do the build out. Our bakers are all local people, small business owners. Gosh, you know, it just, we couldn't have made it happen without them. So we actually had a pretty big partnership, multi-person, multi-business partnership that was helping us out in various ways. But yeah, it was difficult, and it did slow things down.
Now, tell me how it works for people who aren't might not be able to imagine how you can have a coffee shop with the cats and that sort of thing. How does it all work?
Well, basically, one side is just a normal coffee shop. Our space is divided in half. So we have the normal coffee shop on one side, and you can just come in, order coffee, and sit down and work or do whatever you'd like in a normal coffee shop. And then the other half is a room filled with adoptable cats from the Humane Society of Indianapolis. And it's kind of like a living room sort of environment. There's comfy seating in there and tables. And then there's just like a bunch of cat trees and cat toys and cats, of course. And so you can bring your coffee and food in there if you'd like, or you can just sit on the coffee shop side.
And there are windows so that you can watch the cats from the coffee shop side, too.
Yep. So even if you don't want to go into the cat side, you can definitely watch the cats play. And a lot of people seem to enjoy that. In the cat lounge, there are 12 people at one time. And we recommend reservations for that just because sometimes it can get full pretty quickly. We do $5 for an hour in there, or $3 for half an hour, and the money helps us for the upkeep of that room, taking care of the cats, of course taking care of the employees that work on that side and make sure that everybody's playing safe with the cats and the cats are playing safe with the people.
Now tell me how the cat part of it works. These cats are adoptable, right?
Yeah, all the cats are from the Humane Society of Indianapolis, and basically if somebody comes in and sees a cat that they fall in love with, they can talk to an employee and we'll show them how to apply for the cat, and from there, Indy Humane takes on the rest of the adoption process. So we're basically kind of like a foster home or an off-site free-roaming cat room for them, and then the Humane Society just does the whole adoption process, basically.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. There's a new installation at the Great American Songbook Foundation Gallery at the Palladium in Carmel. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us about this tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. Tell me.
The exhibit actually focuses on 8 albums of music that Fitzgerald recorded for Verve Records. She did that back in the 50s and the 60s. Believe it or not, this year marks her 100th birthday, and the party has started in Carmel.
Get on the A-train soon.
Well, our mission is to inspire and educate by celebrating the Great American Songbook, and nobody represents that mission more than Ella Fitzgerald. She is the soundtrack of my life, and I know many other people.
Chris Lewis is vice president of the foundation.
She covered so many genres. She's a wonderful jazz singer, but this body of work that we represent in this exhibit focuses on the greatest songwriters of American popular music.
Archivist Lisa Lobdell assembled the exhibit.
You want a combination of not just her professional life, but her personal life. Who was Ella in private? And so we have some wonderful images of her in Paris, just out on the streets. But we have some commercial ads for one of the LPs. So you get to, as I said, you get to see a little bit of everything.
Most of the items are on loan from the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation, located in Los Angeles.
You can really look and see how the times changed by the clothes that she's wearing and her hair. You're going to learn about her biography, but you're also going to see the LPs. You're going to hear some of the music on our interactive. We have over 30 recordings from the Verve Records on our interactive.
I think there is one with Frank. You want to find that one?
And for the first time, the foundation is offering a traveling companion to the exhibit.
8 panels. They're 6-foot panels, 2-sided panels that available free of charge to schools, organizations, libraries. Anybody who wants to celebrate Ella Fitzgerald and learn about the Great American Songbook, but we've got lesson plans that correspond with it.
Smith says it's a great way to introduce a younger generation to the music and history of the songbook.
Irving Berlin said, history makes music and music makes history. I mean, music is a reflection of what's happening in society at any given time. And this is an important part of our cultural history. And so to be able to take what we do here in this little space in the Palladium and Carmel out to the world and share the songbook in a new and exciting way is the embodiment of our mission.
Sharon, a lot of people don't realize that the Great American Songbook Foundation has this wonderful gallery on the second or third floor there at the Palladium. You can get into it from the west side of the building. It's free. It's open every day. And even if you're not an Ella Fitzgerald fan, it's a great place to go and visit and learn a little bit more about history. But this is a wonderful exhibit, very interactive, and highly recommended for everybody.
Fantastic.
Nice tribute to Ella.
I don't know anybody who doesn't love Ella Fitzgerald. They may not know her name, but they know that style and that distinctive voice.
And the Great American Songbook Foundation is working with a number of schools to bring school children there to learn about it, too, a little bit more about the history of the music and her life. She had a pretty tough life, but she made a pretty fantastic life out of it, too. So you can go to performingarts.org, their website, centerfortheperformingarts.org, for more information and specific hours when that exhibit's open.
Well, you know what? We have lots of things to inspire current and future generations.
I think
it might be time for that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
I can't believe we're getting towards spring. First Friday is this coming Friday night at the Harrison Center. You can see Outside, new work by Justin Vining in the Harrison Gallery and Gallery Annex. He began painting outside in plein air last year in an effort to return to the fundamentals of observational painting and further hone his skills as a painter. And what he didn't expect was that many months later, he would still be painting outside every day, all winter long. So you can check out what he's learned. He's known for big, bold, very cheerful, kind of dramatic work. So I'm eager to see this plein air work and see what the evolution has been. That's all going on at the Harrison Center for the Arts on First Friday night.
Also on First Friday night, it's the WFII Wine Fest, which is going on at the Old National Center. We still have tickets available, so stop by the Wine Fest, and then you can head out and hit some First Friday. It's WFII.org for that information.
Jill, you have a role in Wine Fest. You're hosting, aren't you?
I think we're all going to be there, Sharon, so
Fantastic.
People can come and drink wine and ask us silly questions.
I love that. I love that. I look forward to that. And now for something completely different, a talk on March 9th at IUPUI. It is sponsored by the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute, and it'll be held in the University Library Room. Hang on to that. Here's the topic. The Ethics, Values, and Practices of Public Art in Urban Contexts. It's part of a seminar series, and the question for this talk is, what is public art? So again, what is public art? It's part of a series called The Ethics, Values, and Practices of Public Art in Urban Contexts. It's on March 9th at IUPUI. How far will you go to get what you want? Olivia, a talented but underappreciated mid-career writer, is unexpectedly trapped overnight in a secluded, snowed-in B&B with Ethan, an attractive and wildly successful young blogger. Her latest novel is an unsung masterpiece. His blog is being made into a movie. She's anonymous. He has 500,000 Twitter followers. But opposites soon attract, as each realizes that they want more of what the other have. The name of the play, surely you figured out by now it's a play, is Sex with Strangers. And it's one of the two new productions at the Phoenix Theater right now, running through April 9th.
On Saturday, March the 4th, at the Palladium in Carmel, it's the Vienna Boys Choir. This choir has been in existence for 500 years. It's a group of 25 boys. They're from all over the world. They actually study in Vienna. They study voice. And then part of their curriculum is to go on this world tour. And they will be here on that Saturday night, March the 4th, at the Palladium for a very lively concert. Coming up at the Scottish Rite, which is at 650 North Meridian Street and their Performing Arts Center, it's the play Game Show, and it's being directed by our very own Matthew Soucy. Show dates are March 3rd, 4th, 10th, and 11th, and also a matinee on March the 11th as well. Matthew is a great director, and we invite anybody who's a fan of Matthew to come and see this rollicking
game show.
Rollicking. I love rollicking arts things. Hey, the Indiana Historical Society's new You Are There exhibit is about to open. It debuts March 4th. It's called You Are There, 1943 Italian POWs at Atterbury. And it tells a little-known story about the Italian prisoners of war and the chapel they built at Camp Atterbury, which was their home away from home. You're going to hear more about this soon on The Art of the Matter with an interview, but I wanted to give you the heads up in case you wanted to go out for the opening. And again, this happened in 1943. There were 3,000 Italian POWs at Indiana's Camp Atterbury, a chapter of history we don't remember very well. So this is a chance to learn more and, by the way, take some kids along.
And applications are available online for the 2017 Spirit and Place Festival. This year's theme is power. You have until April the 21st to get your applications in. You can find them at spiritandplace.org.
You know, we have so many more things in our stack of items for our calendar, but we're out of time. So we remind you that if you want to find out more, you can learn about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us next week for our calendar. What'll we do?
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Meredith Brickell's art is usually a response to place, often an abandoned place. She's exhibited mop water from a building slated for demolition and clay bricks recovered from an old chicken barn. Her curiosity about the space around her led to her most recent project on Indy's Near East Side. Contributor Amy Gastella met with Brickell to learn more.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Tito.
Meredith Brickell spends a lot of the day in the garage behind her yellow bungalow. A few chickens huddle by the back steps of the house. Brickell and her husband use the garage as studio space. They're both artists. They moved to Indy's Near East Side from Raleigh, North Carolina 7 years ago. She says when they got here, she was struck by the number of vacant homes.
On some blocks, there will be, I don't know, like less than 10 houses occupied on the whole block.
Brickell says this was really different from Raleigh, where housing is much more expensive. But she also noticed something else.
But the community is very strong here, and we love that.
She knew the issue of vacancy was about more than empty houses. Eventually, Brickell felt called to react with art.
Being aware that, like, aestheticizing these was to some extent exploiting the place as opposed to really revealing something about it or knowing it. So I knew that I wanted to, it needed to be complicated. The inquiry into this needed to be complicated.
She reached out to Renew, a nonprofit that manages city-owned vacant houses. Together, they brought in leadership at the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, and they got project funding from the Ephraimson Family Fund.
And Ephraimson was very generous in letting us take this set of questions that we had and bring a group of people together to see where those questions led.
Renew set them up in a vacant home on Eastern Avenue, and Brickell hired a team of artists. Together, they made installations in response to the house and the surrounding community. So far, they've worked out of two different Eastside homes. They don't own the homes, so when they sell, House Life Project moves.
This temporary occupancy is part of the concept of the project.
Last year, House Life Project hired L. Roberts, who beefed up the project's community outreach, in part through community conversations. These informal gatherings surround topics like housing policy and social practice art. Last summer, they read Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations. In this article, he outlines the history of racist housing policies across the nation.
And that is something, like, as we are sitting there in an abandoned house in, you know, the urban core of Indianapolis, as artists, we need to be knowledgeable about how that situation came to be. And then also be thoughtful about what policies are in place now that are creating change, and how do those relate to past policies.
Last night we looked at some of those other art projects that use not just food, but the act of gathering around a table as a way to...
In January, the Alexander Hotel gave House Life Project a weekend stay in use of a conference room. The team spent this time reading and planning for the upcoming year. And after 3 days in conversation, it's time to celebrate. Downstairs at the hotel restaurant, Christopher Williams, one of the team, told me he was already making music before House Life moved in next door.
And, you know, I felt like it was something I could be a part of and I could show my talent or express myself in a way, you know?
Robert says supporting community artists like Williams is a priority for 2017.
We want more kind of like organic community building with a lot of intention behind it.
These efforts seem to resonate with community leaders. This year, they were awarded $20,000 from the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust.
The Nina grant is helping us to be a more responsive organization, a proactive organization, working in a neighborhood that doesn't have as much access to art-based programming as other neighborhoods.
I ask Williams if he could hum a few bars.
Maybe I could. I can sing a little something. I am ready. Oh, man. It's on the spot. Okay.
Brickle says while the plan for House Life Project can sometimes feel ambiguous, that's okay.
I am ready for love. Why are you hiding from me? I'd quickly give my freedom.
I think if we're really doing our job as artists, we are not predetermining a result.
I am ready for love.
And we allow it to be kind of messy and unclear for a longer period of time, perhaps, than some other disciplines. And I think different things emerge when you give something time to unfold or to develop. And I think that's really good for this conversation about a neighborhood. How do we look at these issues in a different way?
Maybe you think I need to learn maturity. Say, watch what
I just bring this different set of questions, I guess, to the challenges.
But yeah. If you ask me tomorrow, I'll say the same thing. I am ready for love. Okay.
Nice.
Contributor Amy Gastelum hosts and produces the podcast Mother. You can listen to more of her work at motherapodcast.com, and you can learn more about House Life Project at houselifeproject.org. Ballet Theater of Indiana will perform the classic fairy tale Beauty and the Beast March 31st through April 1st with original choreography by company members set to Canadian composer Glenn Boer's score and performed live by two pianists. I invited Sterling Matheson co-artistic director and dancer Audrey Robson to talk about creating new dance for new music.
So how do you decide on repertoire at your company? Is it a group decision?
It's usually myself and Sabrina, my wife and co-director, and since we've been so small these last couple of years, the primary concern has just been, what do we have enough people to do?
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have much luck with, you know, Corsair with only two men. We need a pile of men
to have
to
a lot of
that.
Mirrors on the stage or something.
Yes, mirrors would be great. So that narrows it down quite a bit, and then it comes down to what story we think we can tell the best, or what subject matter we think will resonate with our audience.
And sussing out the storytelling potential, is that based on what dancers you have available to you at any given time?
That's definitely...
Audrey's nodding.
Yeah, that's definitely a factor there. And it can be anything from the way they dance and present themselves to just the size of them. I cast Audrey in Baba Yaga because A, she can dance and she can act really well, and B, because she's tiny. So mm-hmm. I could put her alone and make her, you know, she can portray a young girl, and I'll surround her with tall dancers and she'll look tiny.
Wow, this is like a master class in the secrets of the trade here. Mm-hmm. I used to work at a theater company where there was a big quote on the wall that said, "Life is not fair and theater is less fair than life." And so is dance sometimes, too. I mean, everything yes. in the arts, because sometimes it's, I have a fabulous costume and I have to find the actor or the dancer who fits this costume and can still do the job. But the costume is the primary thing.
Well, and then dance also just has limitations of, oh, I'm sorry, you were only born with so much rotation in your hips or
right.
hamstring.
Right.
You know, that's decided at a genetic level how successful you're going to be.
And as dancers, when you come up against an obstacle like that, how do you get around that? How do you kind of make peace with yourself?
Well, you play to your strengths. Kind of growing up, I was always cast in character roles just because I couldn't fit into a large core of dancers. And so I think I've kind of found my strength in doing that if I couldn't be in a large core of dancers. But I did get that opportunity this past performance at Beer and Ballet. We did La Bayadere. We had 12 dancers performing in La Bayadere. And to help create a forced perspective, we had the tall dancers in the front and the short dancers in the back to create the illusion of depth. Oh. And so that was a neat experience for me, being part of a core of dancers.
Yeah, brilliant. Again, chicanery. I love it. I know when you're seeking company members, you explicitly look for people who have, yes, the core ballet training, but something in addition. Mm-hmm. Is there a particular something in addition? Do you want them to have a particular kind of modern dance, or do you want them to have something else entirely?
I mean, when it comes to dance technique, we do want them to be versatile, but to a certain degree we can train that. Honestly, what I'm usually looking for is something, a skill set that has nothing to do with dance technique at all. Right now we're looking for a dancer with development and fundraising experience.
Uh-huh.
We've got Emma, who's a carpenter and a dancer, or Audrey handles RPR and marketing, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we have a new dancer this year, Miriam, who makes latex prosthetics and does fantastic makeup and makes costumes out of $2 sketchy curtains she found at Goodwill. It's beautiful. The price is right. So, honestly, that's what I'm looking for in addition to the dance technique most of the time.
So you're a very collaborative company, and you share responsibility for setting choreography. How do you divide that up, or how do you work together? How do you get on the same page? How do you share an artistic vocabulary?
It depends on the show. For mixed bills, it's easy. You say, "Hey, Cole, come up with a piece," and he does whatever he wants, and I do whatever I want, and other choreographers do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll put out a call for choreography proposals to our dancers and some of our contacts in the community for those mixed bill shows. But for the full lengths, often the artistic staff will sit down for a meeting, we'll, you know, get lunch, meet at my house, and myself, my wife, Cole, and Annie, our ballet master and ballet mistress, will talk through the show as a whole and look at which parts could be set by which people effectively, talk through the sort of themes and style of the show, and then also, even if, say, Annie isn't going to be setting a part, I might assign her to be the person in charge of rehearsing and cleaning it. So I'll come in, set it in an hour and a half, and then I'm done with it, and it's on her plate.
Now, define the cleaning part. How will she know exactly what you were after?
Well, she'll be in that first rehearsal, for one. So she'll be there for that. If there's any ambiguity, she can always just say, "Hey, Sterling," and ask me a question.
What did you
and
mean?
Then, but most of it, honestly, is just ballet technique. She knows what she's looking for. She can say, "You're not in lines. Your knees aren't straight. Your feet aren't pointed. You need to spot. What on earth are you doing?" Those sorts of things.
Annie's very good at cleaning. She does a good job. And I think part of it, too, is consistency and making sure everyone's arm is at a specific angle. So the people in the front are always right. So if you're following the people in the front and we all look exactly the same, that's the goal.
A lot of discipline.
Yes.
Why is this the right time for Beauty and the Beast for you guys?
It's funny, we kicked around a bunch of different ideas for a few different classical ballets, and part of it was a desire to create a full length from the ground up. And I had just recently heard of the score that the composer Glenn Buhr created for the Birmingham Royal Ballet, and it hasn't really proliferated yet, which is a shame because there are new ballet scores being made. I know Michael Pink created a Picture of Dorian Gray ballet that was supposed to be spectacular last year, but of course I haven't heard of anyone else doing it. And part of that is the difficulty of licensing and things like that, but it seems like there's just not as much of a desire to add full lengths to the repertoire of classics that ballet as a whole is using. And that just makes me sad.
Ballet Theatre of Indiana's Sterling Matheson and Audrey Robson. You can see their production of Beauty and the Beast March 31st and April 1st at the Athenaeum. Learn more at btindiana.org. btindiana.org. Archer Silva and A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long partnered for many years for a project called Cultural Cannibals. Kyle recently caught up with Archer to learn about his new initiatives in California.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined today by visual artist Archer Silva. He's here in Indianapolis for our annual Brazilian Carnival at the Jazz Kitchen. This year it's happening Saturday, February 25th at 10 p.m. You can go to culturalcannibals.org for more information. Artur, thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks, Kyle.
And tell folks what they can expect at this year's Carnival.
We bring every year the band IU Percussion Ensemble, which is a group of percussionists from Bloomington, led by Michael Spire, which is one of the greatest percussionists alive in the country. It's a large band with 18 people. They'll be playing samba tunes all night in two sets for us. Also dancers. We're going to have some Brazilian food and caipirinhas as well, which are Brazilian national drink, and a lot more. It's just a great dance party, phenomenal energy.
And you have five songs to share with us today, not necessarily on the theme of carnival. You have some more serious music picked out for us. What's your first song?
First song is Rosa de Hiroshima, which is written by Vinicius de Moraes, which was a diplomat turned poet who wrote some of the best Brazilian songs ever. This version is performed by Secos e Molhados. And this particular song is about the consequences of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki attack by the United States.
Pensem nas crianças mudas telepáticas. Pensem nas meninas cegas inexatas.
Second song is Um Comunista by Caetano Veloso, who was a revolutionary during the times of the dictatorship. Um Comunista is a song about Carlos Marighella, who was a revolutionary communist in the 60s, and you know, took action in São Paulo, where he was active, but also talks about the complexities of ideology and the structure, the former structure of the Soviet Union, and the desire for equality among humans.
Foi aprendendo a ler, olhando o mundo à volta.
My third song is O Bêbado e o Equilibrista, which is a song by Elis Regina, but written by João Bosco. And it's a song also talking about the dictatorship and by the atrocities that they committed during the 60s and 70s in Brazil.
Caía.
The fourth song is by a group called Clube da Esquina, which prominently features Milton Nascimento. This song is very, very dear to my heart because it reminds me of the mountains of Minas Gerais, where I grew up. And it's also a song that makes reference to Zapata, some of the revolutionaries in Mexico.
Tudo que você queria ser.
And your fifth and final song for us today, Artur?
Mario, which is a song by Criollo. It starts with a chant for Ogun, who is an African god from the Yoruba culture.
Ogun Ajoe Mario. Ogun
Lakae.
Ogun Ajoe Mario.
Ogun Lakae.
Ogun Ajoe Mario.
And Artur, as I mentioned, you're back in Indianapolis for our annual Brazilian Carnival. This year it's happening Saturday, February 25th. Folks can go to culturalcannibals.org for more information on that. And I also wanted to give you a chance to let folks know where they can catch up with all your visual artwork.
That's right. You can check me on Facebook, Instagram, and also artursilva.com.
Artur, thank you. You played some of my favorite songs today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kyle.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Amy Castellum, Lou Harry, and Jill Dittmeyer. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll check out the Tube Factory's newest exhibit and meet the first of 5 American Pianists Association fellows. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.